adapt and go on. After all, survival is what we Jews do best.
Well put, dear, his mother said, as Cornelia entered the dining room with a dish of carciofi alla Giudia, fried artichokes, a Jewish specialty. Sandro's eyes lit up.
Bravissima, Cornelia.
Just for you. Cornelia smiled as she set down the platter, and the fried artichokes looked delicious. The light breading glistened with olive oil and lemon, and was dotted with coarse flakes of sea salt. His father said a prayer over the food, and Sandro plucked a spear of artichoke, taking a bite.
I'm officially consoled.
Good. Cornelia patted his shoulder and went back to the kitchen. Rosa cleared her throat.
I have something to tell everyone, even though this night is already a difficult one. I might as well come out with it. My job at an international relief agency has come through, and everything is in place. I am going to emigrate with David, and it's all set up. I'm sorry to have to tell you tonight, but I'm leaving at the end of the week.
Sandro felt stunned and sad. He had never believed she would go through with it. He didn't know what to say. It felt like a blow, but he would keep that to himself.
So soon?
His mother's hand flew to her mouth. His father's lined face fell.
This is sudden, isn't it?
Not really,
Rosa answered, her tone softer. I've been waiting for it to come through.
I don't want to go without you all, but I'm afraid to stay. I'm afraid for you if you stay.
We'll be fine,
her father said quietly.
We live here, we work here.
We have to stay, Rosa,
her mother added, and Sandro looked down at his plate, stricken. He agreed with his parents, and he certainly didn't want to leave Rome or Elisabetta. But the turn of events had shaken his confidence in his position.
Listen to me one last time.
Rosa leaned over.
What worries me is that at some point you will not be permitted to emigrate. I hear things at the embassy, and I know you'll say that's not official, but it's reliable. Jews all over Europe are fleeing the Nazis, and I know you say Jews are coming to Italy, and you're right. But they'll be in the same terrible position. Those who act quickly have a chance to go. If you delay, it will be only more difficult and more dangerous.
Dangerous?
His father scoffed.
Yes, Papa.
Rosa pursed her lips. Other countries are already moving to block refugees. The United States has quotas on Jews, and it's raising more restrictions. Their State Department procedures are fraught with delay. Even if you can get a visa, there are regulations about how much money you can leave Italy with, and if it's not enough to support you, nobody will admit you. His father frowned, and his mother arched an eyebrow, but Rosa wouldn't let them get a word in.
Nobody wants to take Jews, and even the British are asking applicants to pay thousands of pounds to get a visa to Palestine. If I didn't work at the embassy, it would have been much harder for me. Please, come with me to London. This is your last chance.
No, thank you,
his father said, shaking his head.
We've already told you.
I'm sorry, his mother added.
Sandro felt heartsick, but he could see that his sister was on the verge of tears. He loved her, so he knew what he had to say. Rosa, I understand why you want to go. You should do what you have to do.
Thank you.
Rosa smiled shakily at him, then returned her attention to their parents.
And there's one more thing you have to know. I got married to David in London last week, so now I'm his wife.
What?
His father's mouth dropped open.
You're married?
Rosa.
His mother's eyes rounded behind her glasses.
My goodness, why didn't you tell us?
Sandro looked over, astonished, but Rosa was taking their mother's hand.
Mamma, I didn't tell you because I know how you and Papa felt about me marrying somebody who wasn't Italian. And doesn't that objection seem beside the point after all that's happened? According to the manifesto, we are no longer Italian because we're Jews. Papa, do you see the absurdity?
No. His father folded his arms. The manifesto is still not the law. No one can deny history. We're Italian Jews. We're Roman.
His mother shook her head, stunned.
You could have told us, Rosa. You could have let us know. We weren't even at your wedding.
Rosa looked stricken. I knew you would have tried to talk me out of it, and I didn't want to give you the chance. We had to get married there to improve my chances for immigration.
Sandro understood, though he was sad he hadn't gotten to see her get married either.
He felt happy for Rosa, but remained heartbroken that she was leaving the country. His emotions roiled within him. Everything was going wrong. His father was angry, his mother was reeling, and he couldn't wait until this awful day ended. His father shook his head.
Rosa, he's not Italian. How could you?
We love each other, that's how. Rosa frowned. He's a wonderful man. And we were married in a Jewish ceremony with his parents and brother there.
That doesn't make him Italian.
His father threw up his hands.
We wanted Italian grandchildren.
All of a sudden, Sandro felt the emotions he'd kept inside explode.
Papa, does it matter? First you say I can't see Elisabetta because she's not Jewish. Then you say Rosa can't marry David because he's not Italian.
His father turned to him, wounded.
Your mother and I have wishes for both of you, and we are entitled to that. Where is your respect, son?
I respect you, of course. Sandro realized that he had to think for himself, as Rosa had said, so he did. But can't I disagree with you? Doesn't what happened today demonstrate the fallacy in your logic? People aren't categories, and it's morally wrong to throw me out of my school because I'm Jewish. It hurts people to no end. It's just plain wrong. The government is discriminating against us, so we can't discriminate in return, can we? It's unprincipled.
His mother rose, clutching her napkin, uncharacteristically shaken. Her eyebrows sloped down, and her lower lip trembled.
I hate this fussing. I wanted to see my daughter get married. Now I can't, and I never will.
She held her napkin to her nose as she began to cry. Then she turned and hurried from the room, with Rosa at her heels. It left Sandro and his father alone at the table, and they fell silent, neither speaking to fill the void. Sandro looked down at his plate, trying to sort his emotions. He had to acknowledge a diminishment of respect for his father, whose views simply didn't stand to reason. Sandro never used to have such cross words with him, except for the last conversation about Elisabetta. Sandro wished they could resolve the issue, so he looked up, but was surprised to find his father sitting stiffly upright in his chair. His father's eyes had filmed behind his glasses, and Sandro experienced a wave of regret. Never before had he seen his father cry.
Papa, he said, rising.
But his father waved him to stay in his seat.
When you have children of your own, you'll understand.
Chapter 36. Aldo. October 1938. Bar Girosport was busy, and Aldo manned the coffee machine at the counter with their older barmaid Letizia. His father worked in the outside seating area, taking care of customers and shooing away the accordion player and photographer who tried to make money from the tourists. Marco was serving a table of pretty nurses, and Aldo looked on amused. Marco had always been naturally at ease with women, and Aldo often wished that he had his little brother's charm. But it was unique to him. Aldo loved him too much to be envious.
"Due caffè ristretti,"
Letizia said, meaning two coffees, short and dense. And Aldo picked up a cup and turned the lever on the tall Victoria Arduino coffee machine, with its gleaming eagle on top. He brewed the coffee, his thoughts straying where they always did, to the danger presented by the anti-fascist plans. Spada's retirement party was getting closer, and Aldo was getting more terrified for Marco. To his growing horror, the anti-fascists rehearsed the attack at every meeting, pretending that sticks were guns, since he hadn't been dispatched to Orvieto yet. Every morning and night, he prayed to God for guidance, but none had come. Aldo handed the coffee to Letizia and started brewing another cup, completely preoccupied. He had still been unsuccessful in persuading Marco to quit his job, but had been thinking of an alternative plan. It sounded crazy, but he was considering giving Marco tainted pork on the day of the retirement party, rendering him too sick to go. The only problem was that Marco had an iron stomach, so it would require a lot to get him sick, and Aldo didn't want his little brother to end up in the hospital across the street. Anyway, Marco would go to the party unless he was truly deathly ill, because he couldn't wait to celebrate Spada's departure. Aldo handed Letizia the second coffee, glancing outside. His gaze happened to fall on the blonde hair of a woman taking a seat at one of the tables in their outside seating area. He recognized her. It was Silvia, Uno's wife. Aldo looked down, hiding his face. His heart began to pound. Silvia had no idea that he worked here. If she saw him, she would learn his true identity.
"One coffee, senza schiuma,"
Letizia said, meaning a coffee without the top of foam. Aldo had to get out of sight.
"Letizia, can you cover for me? I have to go to the bathroom."
"Sure,"
Letizia answered. And Aldo left the counter and was about to hurry into the back when he realized that he was too late. Silvia had gotten up and was talking with his father, probably asking him where the bathroom was. In the next moment, Silvia entered the bar, making a bella figura in a nice blue dress that clung to her lithe form. Aldo's mouth went dry. He couldn't let her see him. Meanwhile, the sight of her turned Marco's head, for his brother never missed a pretty girl. Aldo didn't know what to do. He couldn't let Marco start talking to her. Knowing his little brother, he'd bring up his fascio job to impress her, and all would be lost. Aldo froze. Silvia was walking toward him and Marco. He couldn't avoid her. If he went left or right, she would see him move. He turned his head away as if he were talking to some customers. Out of the corner of his eye, he was aghast to see Silvia looking right at him, and she slowed her step. Aldo looked over and met her eye, caught. Silvia gazed directly back at him. Strangely, her expression registered no surprise, and she nodded as if sending him a signal. She made her way to the back of the bar and into the narrow hallway, where the stockroom and restrooms were located. Luckily, Marco looked away, summoned by a customer. Aldo followed Silvia, his mind racing. He turned into the hallway, and Silvia was waiting for him.
"I need to talk to you," she said under her breath. "Okay, in the stockroom."
Aldo showed her inside the tiny room under the stairwell, which was lined with groceries. He closed the door quickly and turned on the light.
"Silvia, what are you doing here?"
"Uno sent me to see you, Aldo."
Aldo felt shocked. "How do you know my name? Or that I work here?"
"Uno found out because we needed to talk to you. It's urgent."
Aldo recoiled. "But how did he find out?"
"He has ways."
Aldo masked his alarm.
"I thought our identities were secret. I thought we trusted each other.
We shouldn't spy on each other.
I agree with you, but you don't understand the risks Uno takes. That's why I came instead of him.
Sylvia's forehead creased.
Trust me, he has good reasons for how he operates. I won't hide anything more from you, so I'll tell you, he knows that your father is a fascist of the first hour.
Aldo thanked God that they didn't know about Marco. He got his bearings.
I'm sure I'm not the only one of our cell to have a father who's a committed fascist. I'm my own man, and nevertheless loyal to our cause.
We know that, and that's not why I've come. I'm here to tell you to go to Orvieto tonight.
Tonight?
Aldo swallowed hard, off balance.
Why tonight? What happened? Something came up, that's all I can say.
Aldo wished he could stall her. The longer he could put off getting the guns, the better.
But I don't know if I'm ready. Why not?
Aldo tried to think of a lie, but he was a terrible liar.
But tonight is such short notice.
It couldn't be helped.
But I have to prepare.
Prepare what?
My bike. I have to get it in order.
Is it broken? Can't you fix it?
No, well, it's not broken, but...
Aldo, are you afraid? Is that it?
Sylvia's blue eyes sharpened with suspicion.
Is that why you've gotten so thin? Is it from anxiety?
Yes,
Aldo answered, sensing that the woman was too smart to believe an outright denial.
But I didn't want to admit it in front of the others.
I knew it. I see things my husband doesn't.
Sylvia patted his arm.
Be brave. It's dangerous, but not unreasonably so. You said you would go, and you must. My husband shouldn't have to do everything. Do your part. Keep your word.
Okay.
Aldo resigned himself to going, as it didn't bring the date of the retirement party any closer.
Bravo.
Sylvia smiled briefly.
Leave after nightfall and be back by morning. Our contact will be waiting for you at a tavern called Piccolo's on Via del Duomo, off the Corso Cavour.
How will I know him?
He goes by Fabio, and he'll be wearing a checked cap. He's going to give you a package of 6 pistols. Ride back to Rome straight away and place them in a hole in the underbrush near the Terme di Caracalla, where Viale delle Terme di Caracalla intersects Via Antonignana. Are you familiar?
No.
I just told you the location. You'll find it with ease. If it's not safe for any reason, hide in place or travel the next night. Don't go back to Orvieto looking for our contact. Understand?
Yes. Good luck. Goodbye.
Sylvia opened the door to the storeroom and left, and Aldo heaved a sigh. His chest felt too small for his lungs to fill, and he always had excellent wind. He left the stockroom and entered the bar. Marco crossed to him with a sly smile.
Aldo, was that her?
Aldo understood the mix-up, which worked to his advantage.
Yes.
A blonde? What a beauty.
Thank you.
Aldo realized that he wouldn't be able to ride home with Marco tonight if he had to go to Orvieto.
She came by to tell me that her husband's going out of town, so I can stay with her the whole night. Will you cover for me with Papa and Mamma?
Yes, of course. But what about in the morning when you're not home?
Aldo felt nonplussed, but Marco's face lit up.
I have an idea.
I'll tell Papa that you felt good and decided to train until late, like take an endurance ride. Then he and Mamma won't wait up. Just be back before they're up in the morning.
Great idea,
Aldo said, forcing a smile. The irony wasn't lost on him that his little brother was helping him obtain the guns that would be turned against him.
Now tell me.
Marco leaned closer, his eyes glinting.
What happened in the stockroom? Did you give her some that quick?
Marco, no,
Aldo chuckled, though he felt sick to his stomach.
It can be done, brother. I know for a fact.
Aldo didn't reply.
except to shove him playfully. Evening darkened into nightfall, and Aldo rode out of Rome and found the back roads heading north. He kept an eye on the traffic around him, making sure he wasn't followed, but he felt safe. His thoughts churned as he went, knowing that each revolution of his wheels brought him closer to something he dreaded. He had to save Marco, and tainted pork seemed like his best alternative. Over 3 hours passed on the bike, and Aldo finally reached the medieval town of Orvieto. He rode through its cobblestone streets and found Piccolo's, a shabby bar on a narrow street lined by closed shops. Everything was dark except for the tavern, which shed an elliptical shaft of light onto the sidewalk. Slumping against the wall near the entrance was a man in a checked cap, drinking from a wine bottle. It had to be Fabio, posing as a drunk. On the ground next to Fabio lay a bulky package wrapped in brown paper and twine. The guns. Aldo slowed his pace, glancing around to make sure he wasn't being watched. The street was deserted, and no one was around. A dog barked in the distance, otherwise there was absolute stillness. In the next moment, Fabio rose, wobbly, and staggered away, pretending to lean on the wall to steady himself. The wrapped package remained on the ground. Aldo didn't hesitate. He sped up, leaned over as he rode past, snatched it, and kept going. It was heavy, and he tossed it into the pouch on his handlebars. Aldo found his heart beating hard now that he had the pistols. There really was no going back now. He sent up a prayer for forgiveness. He resolved again to find a way to save Marco. Now it was time to get back to Rome. He scanned the street, and it remained empty, dark, and quiet. He rode down the street, turned around, and steered back the way he came, due south. His eyes swept the streets as he pedaled faster, heading out of town. He left Orvieto and kept going, every muscle tense as he gripped the handlebars. His thighs began to burn, and he accelerated, barreling into the dark night. The road wound this way and that, with a long ride ahead. The pistols in the pouch clinked against each other, making noise when he hit a bump. Aldo lowered his upper body to improve his aerodynamics. He made his way through pastures with grazing horses and cows in the darkness. The headlights of a passing car shone on him, but he ignored it. He accelerated, then the car accelerated, but didn't pass him. He didn't understand. He signaled to the car to pass him, but it didn't. It didn't make sense. Aldo held steady with the car at his heels over his right shoulder. The big headlights illuminated him. He glanced over his shoulder to see it was a big, dark sedan. He felt a tremor of fright. He told himself to calm down, but it wasn't working. He slowed, but the sedan slowed too. He sped up, and the sedan sped up, but it still didn't pass him. Fear bolted through him, powering his fatigued body. The sedan dogged his back tire, toying with him. Aldo pedaled harder, channeling his fear into effort. The sedan sped so close that he could feel heat emanating from its big engine. He heard men laughing. Maybe drinkers, having fun at his expense. There was no one around to help. He was on his own. The sedan gunned its engine, gaining on him. He couldn't hope to outrun them, but he kept going, his heart hammering from a growing terror. Suddenly a bottle hit his shoulder, and the men burst into raucous laughter. Aldo gripped the handlebars but didn't fall. His front tire wobbled, but he kept control. He tried to think of a way out. There was none. He was on a long stretch of road flanked by fences and farms, with no byway to the left or right. The men in the sedan must know the roads better than he. He was frightened, but prayed they would leave him alone. Aldo could barely see in the darkness. Ahead, the road curved to the right and disappeared. The wind buffeted him broadside, and clouds raced to conceal the moon. He steered around the curve to the right, then saw to his horror that the road was blocked by a line of sedans that were facing him head-on. Their headlights were switched off. An ambush. Aldo braked as hard as he could. The cars switched on their headlights, blasting him with light, blinding him. He slid into a fall. His bicycle vanished from under him. The package of guns flew from the pouch. Everything happened at once. He fell to the ground, half rolling and half skidding off the road. The asphalt tore his jersey off and flayed his skin. An agonizing pain ripped through his arms and legs. He couldn't hold a single thought. Aldo found himself coming to a stop in a grassy ditch, hitting a fence post. He smelled manure. He heard the thundering of hooves as horses ran off. He struggled to maintain consciousness. The pain was agonizing. He hurt everywhere. He felt warmth all over his face. He knew it was his own blood. He opened his eyes with effort. Above him loomed a line of dark silhouettes, brandishing long clubs. Fascists. Aldo felt his heart thunder with terror. The fascists must have discovered their plans. He struggled to his feet, but his legs buckled under him. Pain exploded in his right knee. It must be broken. He pitched forward and crumpled to the ground. His blood drenched him. He smelled the metallic odor. The men laughed, coming for him.
Bolshevik pig! You're under arrest, communist!
I see a gun on him, don't you?
Yes, I see it too. We have to defend ourselves.
Aldo realized they were going to kill him, not arrest him. He tried to crawl away, his legs seared with agony. He panted and grunted like an animal. He clawed his way forward with his fingers.
Come on, boy, run for it, make it fun!
A club whacked him from behind. He heard his scapula crack and splinter. Excruciating pain shot through his body. He refused to cry out. If he was going to die, it would be with bravery.
Come on, get up and run, you good for nothing!
The men began pounding Aldo with clubs, breaking his ribs, his elbow, his legs. He writhed in agony. Someone kicked him in the head. He began to lose consciousness. Suddenly, Aldo felt no pain. His life began to ebb away. He recited the Hail Mary. It was the hour of his death. His soul left his body, and he felt himself looking down on the young man lying beside a country road, being beaten by the men who had stolen his country. He thought of his family. He loved them so much. He regretted that he had never let them know him truly. He had kept himself to himself. He regretted that he had never been loved by a woman. He would have been the most devoted of husbands. He hadn't wanted to leave his life so soon. Yet he knew he was going to a better life, an eternal one, in the embrace of a just and loving God. And in his last moment, he felt the deepest anguish, for now he could no longer protect his beloved Marco.
Chapter 37. Marco. October 1938. It was a slow morning at Bar Girosport, with Marco at the counter with Letizia, since Aldo hadn't come home last night. His parents had been surprised to wake up to Aldo's absence, and they had worried. So Marco had told them that Aldo had been seeing a married girlfriend, and had undoubtedly overslept there. Now both sons were in trouble, with their parents angry at them for lying, and at Aldo for having an affair with a married woman. Marco simmered at the utter hypocrisy of his father's reaction, and resentment boiled within him. He looked up from the counter, surprised to see his boss, Commendatore Buonaccorso, entering the bar with his father. Marco wondered if he was getting a promotion, since things had been going so well at work. His father motioned him forward. So Marco asked Letizia to take over, left the counter, and saluted his boss.
Commendatore Bonacorso, it's good to see you.
Bonacorso nodded, his expression unusually grim. I'm here to speak with you and your parents. Marco followed his father and Bonacorso into the kitchen, which had a small hallway before the cooking area and oven in the back. His mother looked up from the stove and wiped her hands on her apron as she came forward.
Commendatore, she said, smiling, I'm pleased to see you. May I get you something for breakfast?
No, thank you, signora.
Bonacorso took off his hat.
Marco, is there a seat, perhaps?
Yes, Commendatore.
Marco grabbed an old stool and pushed it toward his boss.
Sir, please sit down.
No, this seat is intended for your mother.
Bonacorso motioned.
Signora, please, sit down.
Thank you. How thoughtful.
His mother eased onto the seat, obviously impressed by the Commendatore's manners. Bonacorso cleared his throat.
Beppe, Maria, Marco, I'm sorry, but I have terrible news. There is no way to mince words. I regret to inform you that your Aldo is dead. He was an anti-fascist. He was killed while transporting pistols to Rome, presumably for his comrades.
Marco gasped, horrified. It wasn't possible. He couldn't believe what he was hearing.
No, his father said hoarsely. This can't be. You must be mistaken.
His mother's hand flew to her mouth, her eyes widening with horror, but she made no sound. The incident took place last night outside Orvieto, Bonacorso explained.
Aldo was stopped as he rode south to Rome. 5 pistols were found in a package on his bicycle. He also had a pistol on his person. He resisted arrest and shot at the officers, almost killing one. Aldo was killed in self-defense.
This can't be. His father shook his head. His mother covered her face with her hands. Marco's mind reeled. His lower lip trembled, but he found his voice.
Sir, there must be some mistake. Aldo was with his girlfriend last night. I'm sure he's still there. I promise you he'll be home any minute.
Marco, there is no mistake. These facts are true.
But I know he's with his girlfriend. He went there last night. He goes there at night when he's supposed to be training. He's in love.
That is not where he has been going, Marco. Bonacorso frowned. I cannot divulge further details, but Ovra has been surveilling the members of an anti-fascist cell. The traitors have been meeting in the catacombs at night. Aldo has been identified as being there routinely among them.
Marco opened his mouth, but uttered no words. Aldo was gone. Tears flooded his eyes. He could barely hear the Commendatore, who kept speaking.
Aldo's body is in transit. He had his identity card on his person, and Beppe, you will be asked to provide final identification of his body and sign the proper forms.
My condolences.
His father remained in emotional control, his expression rigid.
Commendatore Bonacorso, I assure you that my son Aldo is no traditore. Aldo loved Mussolini and our country. You know I am a fascist of the first hour. I raised my family in fascism. Marco is loyal to our party, and Aldo is the same way.
Beppe, I understand this comes as a shock, so I won't speak further on the matter. I take my leave of you now so that you may mourn together.
Bonacorso put his hat back on.
As a matter of security, we will not report the details of this matter to the press. We will report instead that Aldo perished in a bicycle accident and his body was found by police.
Smoky incense thickened the air, and Marco sat in his stiff black suit, facing the altar. Aldo's funeral mass was almost over, though Marco hadn't heard a word. The colorful icon that depicted Madonna and Child against lapis lazuli flickered in the soft light of white tapers, and the only sound was the droning Latin of Father Donato and the occasional coughing of the congregation. Marco, Emedio, and their mother had cried so much the past few days, but their father hadn't shed a tear, even after identifying Aldo's body, which had shown bullet wounds and signs of a beating, presumably the police venting their anger on his corpse. His father was deeply ashamed that Aldo had died as an anti-fascist. It only stoked Marco's resentment against his father, for he himself mourned Aldo regardless of politics, and his love for his brother would never go away. Marco remembered playing ball with Aldo in the Piazza San Bartolomeo all'Isola, then cuddling with him at night since they slept in the same bed when they were little. Aldo had taught him how to fix a tire and operate the coffee machine. It was impossible to imagine life without Aldo's quiet, constant presence, for his brother had been as foundational as the cobblestones beneath Marco's feet. The funeral mass ended, and Father Donato swung a silver thurible on a chain, leaving pungent trails of grey smoke. Marco left the pew, then lined up beside Aldo's coffin with his father and the other pallbearers. They lifted the casket onto their shoulders with a whispered, "Uno, due, tre," and egressed slowly, moving into a shaft of sunlight in the middle of the aisle. Marco bore his brother's casket outside and loaded it into the undertaker's hearse. Mourners left the church, and he noticed Elisabetta among them, standing with Sandro and his parents. Her beautiful dark eyes, flooded with tears, spoke to his heart. He stepped away to go to her, but heard his father's voice booming through the air.
"Marco, no! Get in the car!"
Marco turned around, shocked to see his father charging toward him through the mourners, red-faced.
"Get in the car!"
His father clamped Marco on the shoulder and yanked him away from Elisabetta.
"This is your brother's funeral!"
"Papa, no!" His father slapped him, and Marco's hand flew to his cheek. Elisabetta gasped. Marco's mother and Emedio recoiled, and the Simones edged away. His father grabbed Marco by the shoulder, but Marco broke his father's grip, confronting him.
"You want to tell me what to do? But I know what you did. I know who you are. I know!"
Clearly stunned, his father punched Marco, connecting with his left cheek, and Marco staggered backward, dizzy with pain. His mother wailed, Emedio shouted, and the mourners broke into horrified comment. Marco ignored them, and all of the anger and resentment that had been intensifying within him exploded. He swung hard at his father, punching him in the temple. His father stumbled backward, arms flailing. Emedio, Massimo, and Sandro rushed to break them up, but Marco cocked his right arm. He didn't throw the punch. His father looked him in the eye, realizing that Marco had pulled his punch, then lunged at him with the force of a freight train. The impact almost knocked Marco down. But Emedio, Sandro, Massimo, and other mourners surged forward and managed to tear father and son apart, yet both of them struggled against the restraint, torquing this way and that. Even in the chaos, Marco knew that he was no longer under his father's control. He was his own man now, and nothing between them would ever be the same.
Chapter 38 Massimo. November 1938. Massimo hurried up the stairway in the synagogue. Another set of race laws had been issued this morning, and the board was in an uproar. He reached the Sala del Consiglio, or the conference room, which was lined with bookshelves and dominated by a long, polished conference table and chairs. Men sat in groups, holding copies of the new law. Rabbi Zolli was on the phone in his office, trying to compose the community's response. Massimo spotted his friends Luciano and Armando at the conference table. They were businessmen, Luciano in commercial real estate and Armando in banking. Luciano was tall and thin, but Armando short and round. Their faces were equally grave.
Ciao, Massimo. Sit down.
Luciano pulled out a wooden chair.
Thanks for coming so quickly. This is a catastrophe. I know it's very disconcerting.
Massimo sat down, opening his briefcase.
Disconcerting? It's terrifying.
Luciano shook his head, pained.
When I left the house, my wife was in tears.
Armando frowned.
When I left the office, my partners were in tears. Anyway, what do you think? I have a plan.
Massimo took out his copy of the new laws.
Measures for the defense of the Italian race. First, let's go through it quickly, for the end is what matters. The objective of the law is in item 1, measures regarding marriages, and articles 1 through 7 relating to intermarriage between Jews and Gentiles. From now on, the marriage of an Italian citizen of the Aryan race with a person belonging to another race is prohibited.
In other words, no intermarriage.
Exactly.
It was not lost on Massimo that under the new race law, Sandro would no longer be permitted to marry Elisabetta.
Item 2, Article 8 defines what is a Jew, and Article 9 states that membership in the Jewish race must be reported and entered into official registers. This was codified before, if you recall.
Luciano scowled.
It's discriminatory treatment. Gentiles don't have to do any such thing.
Armando nodded.
I agree.
Massimo returned to the law.
These are laws that codify injustice. Nevertheless, we move on. Article 10 provides that Jews may not serve in the military, act as guardians, or be owners or managers of companies related to national defense, or companies of any kind that employ 100 or more people.
He looked up.
This is a terrible provision. Most of my clients own businesses that qualify. This will ruin my practice.
Luciano groaned.
Me too.
Armando's face fell.
I'll go bankrupt.
Massimo remained on course. His friends needed his guidance, not his emotions.
Section D provides that Jews cannot own land valued over 5,000 lire, which I believe we all do. Section E provides Jews can't own any urban buildings with a taxable value of over 20,000 lira, which includes me.
Luciano pursed his lips.
We live in the suburbs, but my wife's family owns the house.
Armando plopped his chin into his hand.
I own my house too, or I used to, until today.
Massimo nodded.
One could form a corporate entity and transfer the property to it, transfer the property to non-Jewish members of the family or to trusted friends, or even transfer it to a charitable institution.
Luciano nodded.
But wouldn't that be considered a fraudulent transfer? In theory, but not as a practical matter. From my research, there's only a handful of people set up to administer this law. They're going to be deluged with applications for exemptions. I doubt they'll get to questioning transfers of property valid on their face.
Armando added,
True, no one has ever extolled the efficiency of the Roman bureaucracy.
Massimo moved on.
Article 12 provides Jews may not employ Gentile servants. We lose our housekeeper Cornelia. Who needs the job?
Luciano nodded.
We hired a nurse for my youngest since my wife got so sick.
Massimo pushed his glasses up.
Article 13 excludes Jews from employment in any public capacity, including the fascist party. Many people in our community are going to lose their jobs.
He straightened.
But now we come to the most important part, the discriminazioni, the exemptions, or those to whom the laws do not apply. There are categories of exemptions. First, for various types of veterans, and under number 4, those who were fascists in the years 1919, 1920, 1921, and 1922, and the second half of 1924.
Luciano leaned over.
That's you, isn't it, Massimo?
You're a fascist of the first hour, so you're exempted, aren't you?
Close, but not technically. I joined in 1923.
We're not fascists. There are no exemptions for us.
Yes, there are.
Massimo pointed to the last provision.
This brings me to my strategy. There is an express exemption for any Jew with exceptional merits to be evaluated according to Article 16.
Armando scoffed.
That's a catch-all term. It doesn't mean anything. I beg to differ.
Massimo corrected him.
Article 16 is going to be our salvation. The tax code works in the same way. It contains terms that invite ambiguity, and when I see them, I turn that disadvantage to an advantage.
He ran his finger down the page.
For example, I think the exemption for exceptional merits applies to both of you. You both served in the Great War, and I believe one of you even received a medal for valor, didn't you?
I did,
Luciano answered proudly.
What else is a medal if not an example of exceptional merit? I served as an army officer in the 29th Piedmont Infantry, and I will be sure to include my military service on my own application. Likewise, you are both leaders in the business community, which is exceptional per se.
Massimo grew encouraged.
Do you see? The provision has to mean something. All we have to do is come up with rationales to construe it in a way that exempts the most members of our community.
Armando frowned.
But this law intends to discriminate against Jews. They're not going to give us an exemption for helping Jews, are they?
Good point. But this law also classifies Jews, as illustrated by the provisions regarding what constitutes a Jew. So, we are going to file applications for exemptions for as many Jews as we can and show how exceptional they are.
Massimo gestured around the room.
These men are leaders of business, scholars, and professionals. We can make arguments for all of them.
Luciano's dark eyes lit up.
You know, we could give out titles to suggest that the duty they perform benefits the community or Rome.
Good idea.
Armando sat taller, rallying.
Great idea.
Massimo smiled.
We'll centralize our efforts here at the synagogue. Everyone can come, and we'll interview them, elicit useful facts about them, and draft exemptions for them.
Armando blinked.
But Massimo, we're not lawyers. You'd have to supervise us.
I will,
Massimo agreed, though he'd never supervise anyone but his secretary.
Gentlemen, I know how unjust this law is and how dire our position, but we are the leaders of this community. Everyone counts on us. We have to move to a solution. It will take work, but we can do it, as we did with the schools.
Massimo, stand up right now. Everyone, listen.
Luciano rose, then clapped to get attention. Heads began to turn, and every man faced him. Massimo stayed in his seat, unaccustomed to the limelight. But Luciano hoisted Massimo up by his arm and began speaking.
Friends, as you may know, Massimo Simone is one of the best lawyers in the city. He has just told me a strategy for us to cope with these terrible race laws.
What is it?
A man called out. Then others joined in.
Tell us, what can we do?
Massimo will tell you.
Luciano called back, stepping aside.
I will?
Massimo asked, nervous.
Massimo, you explain it better than I do. Tell them.
Massimo picked up his notepad with a shaking hand.
I'll begin by explaining the law.
Chapter 39. Marco. November 1938. Marco walked through Piazza Navona much more slowly than the businessmen, shopkeepers, and tradesmen around him. It was his first day at work after Aldo's funeral, and he felt heartsick and grief-stricken, having been barely able to sleep. He wasn't speaking to his father, and they avoided each other. His mother had taken to bed, bereft. Marco approached the grand archway to Palazzo Braschi and saluted.
Good morning, Nino.
Sorry about your brother.
Nino snapped his eyes forward, unusually official.
Thank you. Marco passed through the vaulted entranceway and turned right to the glass doors, where Giuseppe and Tino stood guard, their demeanor similarly cool. Marco saluted them too.
Good morning.
Good morning, Marco.
Condolences.
Thank you. Marco realized that they must have heard that Aldo had died an anti-fascist, but he wasn't about to let their hard eyes bother him. He headed for the grand marble staircase and reached the top floor, which was flooded with sunlight from its floor-to-ceiling windows. He crossed to Commendatore Buonaccorso's office, as he always checked in before the day started.
Good morning,
Marco said to Pasquale, who stood guard by the arch, and they saluted each other.
Condolences,
Pasquale said, and Marco went to his boss's office and knocked on the mahogany door. Buonaccorso called him to come in, and Marco opened the door and saluted, but was taken aback at the sight. His boss sat behind his desk, but standing next to him was an Ovra officer built like a bear, with a bald head and a fierce glare. Ovra was Mussolini's secret police, a law unto themselves. Marco felt a tingle of fear as he walked to the desk.
Commendatore Buonaccorso, good morning. May I get you anything?
No, Buonaccorso motioned. Sit down.
Yes, sir.
Marco sat, and the Ovra officer glared at him without introducing himself, a bad sign. Buonaccorso frowned.
Marco, you're fired.
You can't continue at Fascio headquarters now that we know you had a subversive for a brother.
Marco recoiled. But Aldo truly wasn't like that, I promise you.
How can you defend him? Buonaccorso's dark eyes flashed.
He tried to kill an officer of the law. He was a violent anti-fascist and a communist co-conspirator. He was transporting guns to use against us.
He may have, but he paid the ultimate price, and
which is as it should be,
Buonaccorso interrupted sternly.
I am not my brother, sir. I had no idea of his leftist politics. We never discussed it. He kept it to himself.
Is that true? Buonaccorso arched an eyebrow. You had no idea.
I swear to you, sir, I didn't know. You can't fire me for what my brother did.
It's a matter of trust, Marco. I can no longer trust you.
Sir, you can. I prove it every day working for you. I've learned confidential information here. It never leaves this building.
The Ovra officer slammed his meaty hand on the desk and advanced on Marco, leaning into his face.
Your brother was a criminal subversive. We must assume you are too.
But I'm not.
Yes, you are.
The Ovra officer's glare bored into Marco.
He was in an anti-fascist cell, and you are too.
Marco's mouth went dry.
I swear to you, I didn't know anything about it. I'm a patriot, a good fascist, and I love Il Duce and our party. I would never do anything against...
I don't believe you. You're in it with your brother.
No, no, I swear to you...
You work here in order to spy on us.
No, that's not true. I didn't know.
You showed off at the bar for Commendatore Buonaccorso. You tricked him into believing you were a patriot.
My patriotism is no trick.
Marco could barely respond to the rapid-fire accusations.
You expect us to believe that he never told you? You lived with your brother. You rode with him.
He said he was seeing a married woman.
You came home at the same time. You were seen.
Marco tried to think through his fear, which was intensifying.
We planned it that way for my father. We lied to him.
So you admit you're a liar. You're lying to us. You were in cahoots with your brother and the other filthy pigs. Who are they?
I don't know. I'm telling you, I had no idea he was meeting with them.
That's why your father fought you at the funeral. He found out you were an anti-fascist.
The fight had nothing to do with Aldo. It was about my girlfriend.
Marco flashed on Elisabetta, then thought of Aldo's girlfriend, or whoever she had been.
Wait a minute, listen. One of the anti-fascists came to the bar that day. She was a pretty blonde, the one Aldo said he was having an affair with. They married.
You saw her?
The Ovra officer blinked.
A woman anti-fascist?
Yes.
Marco had forgotten about her in his grief.
She's the one you need to talk to.
What's her name?
I don't know. He never told me.
Where does she live?
I don't know.
You were in cahoots with her.
The Ovra officer shoved a clenched fist in Marco's face.
Is this what you want? I could take you to the Questura right now. I'll beat you until you talk. I want to, but your boss says no. He's a gentleman. I'm not.
Wait, listen.
Marco got an idea.
I can find out who she is. It will prove I'm not an anti-fascist.
The Ovra officer thought this over.
Do it. You have 24 hours. We'll be watching. Understand?
I understand.
24 hours.
Chapter 40. Elisabetta, November 1938. Elisabetta stood in the kitchen at home, wiping her brow and surveying her handiwork. She had finally finished packing to move, and piles of boxes surrounded her. She had sold anything she could part with, like her mother's dresses, shoes, and handbags, which had fetched a tidy sum from the peddlers in the ghetto. Her father's clothes had brought in far less money, and for sentimental reasons, she kept his wonderful watercolors from his heyday as an artist. Most of the furniture was gone, as she had sold everything she wouldn't need. She would have a single room from now on, which would simplify her life. She was trying to look forward, not backward. Such thoughts were more productive than thinking of her father's death. She had come to accept that she was better off without her mother. She sank into the wooden chair, realizing for the first time that the room was very small. She had always thought of the kitchen as very big, and it seemed paradoxical to her that the kitchen would look smaller without anything in it. But it was true. She saw her home with new eyes, realizing that she was leaving this part of her life behind, now that she was an adult on her own, with Rico. The cat looked over from his seat atop a tall stack of boxes, from which he had been eyeing her, neither disapproving nor approving, merely watchful. Rico was intelligent enough to understand that they were leaving, and that he was going too, for he had seen her pack his favorite dishes, which would have allayed any anxiety he might have had.
"Don't worry, Rico," Elisabetta told him anyway.
But his only response was to blink, then stretch the way he always did, first extending his front legs and arching his back, then his back legs, with his tail straight up in the air like an exclamation mark. He crouched, looking down from the box, and Elisabetta realized he was getting ready to jump to the table. But his perch was too high and the table was too far across the room, a dangerous trajectory.
"Rico, no," Elisabetta said, warning him off.
Rico sat back down, generally disappointed in her for preempting his acts of bravery and athletic daring. He would be good company going forward, and she still had Marco and Sandro. She didn't want to risk losing one or hurting the other, which would happen if she made her choice. Her thoughts were interrupted by Rico, who had nevertheless decided to leap from the tower of boxes to the table. Despite the danger, he landed perfectly, then sat down and tucked his tail around himself in a perfect circle, forming a period at the end of his own sentence. Elisabetta chuckled, admiring Rico for taking the risk, as he trusted himself that much. She found herself wondering if she could learn something from him. If she trusted herself more, Perhaps she could choose between Sandro and Marco. She remembered what Nonna had told her, that her heart had already made its choice and would tell her its secret when she was ready to listen. She found herself sitting among the boxes in the hollow husk of her house with only a male cat for female advice. She closed her eyes, quieted her thoughts, and opened her heart wide enough for it to release its secret, which fluttered out like a dove from a cage flying heavenward. In that moment, Elisabetta made a choice, and as soon as she did, her heart affirmed that she had chosen correctly, for the decision resonated within her. Joy suffused her, and her happy gaze met Rico's. "Prego," Rico said with his eyes.
Chapter 41. Marco. November 1938. Marco ran home over the Ponte Fabrizio and found his father working in the outside seating area. They weren't speaking, but this was an emergency. Out of breath, he took his father aside.
"Papa, do you remember a blonde customer who came to the bar the day Aldo was killed? She was pretty and sat outside. She met with him that day."
His father frowned.
"No, I don't remember. Why?"
"What about the photographer who takes pictures of the tourists for money? The one you always shoo away?"
"You mean Corrado?"
"Yes. Was he here that day?"
"I don't know. He's a pest, though."
"Do you know where he lives?"
"No, but he works at a camera shop in Trastevere, on Via della Lungaretta."
Marco took off, running full speed over the Ponte Cestio into Trastevere. He darted past mothers with children and deliverymen pushing barrows, then made a left, hurrying under ivy bowers. He ran until he spotted the camera shop up ahead with a hand-painted sign and storefront. He burst through the door, startling the elderly shopkeeper, who was small with flyaway white hair. He had been reading the newspaper with a magnifying glass, and he looked up from behind a display case that held an array of used Leica, Bencini, and Kine Exacta cameras. Marco had no time for small talk.
"Sir, does a man named Corrado work here? I need to speak with him."
"In the dark room in back."
The shopkeeper set down the magnifying glass.
"But he's busy."
"I can't wait."
Marco came around the counter, and the shopkeeper edged backward, raising his arthritic hands.
"Don't hurt me,"
he cried out, which caught Marco up short. He forgot that some people were intimidated by his uniform.
"I wouldn't hurt you, sir. I need to see him without delay. It's an urgent matter about my family."
"Okay, I'll show you. The dark room must remain light tight."
The shopkeeper led Marco behind the counter to a heavy curtain, which he moved aside, then knocked at a door, calling out,
"Corrado, there's a man who needs to see you. He says it's urgent."
"Fine,"
Corrado called from within.
"Use the double door."
The shopkeeper held aside the curtain, and Marco opened the door, found himself in a dark vestibule with another door, and closed the first door behind him. He opened the next door, entering a room that was completely dark, except for a small orange lamplight that illuminated a shelf of bottles and jugs